Chapter 9. And an Overlord's Trousers. What's the matter? Artemisia did not have to feign uneasiness. She spoke to Gilbert, who, with the captain of the guard, was at the door. Half a dozen uniformed men hovered discreetly in the background. Then quickly, "Has anything happened to father?"
"No, no," Gilbert assured her. "Nothing has happened that need concern you at all.
Were you asleep?" "Just about," she replied. "And my girls have been about their own affairs for hours. There was no one to answer but myself, and you nearly frightened me to death." She turned to the captain suddenly, with a stiffening attitude. "What is wanted of me, captain? Quickly, please. This is not the time of day for a proper audience." Gilbert broke in before the other could more than open his mouth.
"A most amusing thing, Arta. The young man, what's his name, you know, has dashed off, breaking two heads on his way. We're hunting him on even terms now, one platoon of soldiers to one fugitive. And here I am myself, hot on the trail, delighting our good captain with my zeal and courage."
Artemisia managed to look completely bewildered. Under his breath, the captain muttered a monosyllabic imprecation. His lips scarcely moved. He said then,
"If you please, my lord, you are not quite plain, and we are delaying matters insufferably. My lady, the man who calls himself the son of the ex-rancher of Widimos, has been arrested for treason. He has managed to escape and is now at large. We must search the palace for him, room by room."
Artemisia stepped back, frowning. "Including my room?"
"If your ladyship permits."
"Ah, but I do not. I would certainly know if there was a strange man in my room, and the suggestion that I might be having dealings with such a man, or any strange man, at this time of night, is highly improper. Please observe due respect for my position, captain."
It worked quite well. The captain could only bow and say, "No such implication was intended, my lady. Your pardon for annoying you at this time of night. Your statement that you have not seen the fugitive is, of course, sufficient. Under the circumstances, it was necessary to assure ourselves of your safety. He is a dangerous man."
"Surely not so dangerous that he cannot be handled by you and your company."
Gilbert's high-pitched voice interposed again.
"Captain, come, come. While you exchange courtly sentiments with my niece, our man has had time to rifle the armory. I would suggest that you leave a guard at the Lady Artemisia's door, so that what remains of her sleep will not be further disturbed. Unless, my dear," and he twinkled his fingers at Artemisia, "you would care to join us?"
"I shall satisfy myself," said Artemisia coldly, "in locking my door and retiring. Thank you."
"Pick a large one," cried Gilbert. "Take that one.
A fine uniform our guards have, Artemisia. You could recognize a guard as far as you can see him by his uniform alone."
"My lord," said the captain impatiently, "there is no time. You delay matters."
At a gesture from him, a guard fell out of the platoon, saluted Artemisia through the closing door, then the captain. The sound of ordered footsteps fell away in both directions. Artemisia waited, then slid the door quietly open an inch or two. The guard was there, legs apart, back rigid, right hand armed, left hand at his alarm button. He was the guard suggested by Gilbert, a tall one. As tall as Byron of Widimos, though without his breadth of shoulders. It occurred to her, at that moment, that Byron, though young and, therefore, rather unreasonable in some of his viewpoints, was at least large and well-muscled, which was convenient. It had been foolish of her to snap at him. Quite pleasant-looking, too. She closed the door and stepped toward the dressing room. Byron tensed as the door slid away again. He held his breath and his fingers stiffened. Artemisia stared at his whips. "Be careful." He puffed out his breath in relief and stuffed each into a pocket. They were very uncomfortable there, but he had no proper holsters. He said, "That was just in case it was somebody looking for me. Come out and speak in a whisper." She was still in her night robe, woven out of a smooth fabric with which Byron was unfamiliar, adorned with little tufts of silvery fur, and clinging to the body through some faint static attraction inherent in the material, so that neither buttons, clasps, loops, or seam fields were necessary. Nor, as a consequence, did it do more than merely faintly dim the outlines of Artemisia's figure. Byron felt his ears reddening and liked the sensation very much. Artemisia waited, then made a little whirring gesture with her forefinger and said, "Do you mind?" Byron looked up at her face.
"What?"
"Oh, sorry. He turned his back to her and remained stiffly attentive to the faint rustling of the change of outer garments. It did not occur to him to wonder why she did not use the dressing room, or why, better still, she had not changed before opening the door. There are depths in feminine psychology which, without experience, defy analysis. She was in black when he turned, a two-piece suit which did not reach below the knee. It had that more substantial appearance that went with clothing meant for the outdoors rather than for the ballroom. Byron said automatically, "Are we leaving then?" She shook her head. "You'll have to do your part first. You'll need other clothes yourself. Get to one side of the door, and I'll have the guard in."
"What guard?"
She smiled briefly. "They left a guard at the door, at Uncle Gil's suggestion." The door to the corridor ran smoothly along its runners an inch or two. The guard was still there, stiffly immobile. "Guard," she whispered, "in here, quickly." There was no reason for a common soldier to hesitate in his obedience to the director's daughter. He entered the widening door with a respectful,
"At your service, my li-"
And then his knees buckled under the weight which came down upon his shoulders while his words were cut off, without even an interrupting squawk by the forearm which slammed against his larynx. Artemisia closed the door hurriedly and watched with sensations that amounted almost to nausea. The life in the palace of the Henriades was mild almost to decadence, and she had never before seen a man's face congest with blood and his mouth yawn and puff futilely under the influence of asphyxia. She looked away. Byron bared his teeth with effort as he tightened the circle of bone and muscle around the other's throat. For a minute, the guard's weakening hands ripped futilely at Byron's arm, while his feet groped in aimless kicks. Byron heaved him clear of the floor without relaxing his grip. And then the guard's hands fell to his sides, his legs hung loosely, and the convulsive and useless heavings of the chest began to subside. Byron lowered him gently to the floor. The guard sprawled out limply, as though he were a sack which had been emptied.
"Is he dead?"
asked Artemisia in a horrified whisper.
"I doubt it," said Byron. "It takes 4 or 5 minutes of it to kill a man. But he'll be out of things for a while. Do you have anything to tie him up with?"
She shook her head. For the moment, she felt quite helpless. Byron said, "You must have some cellite stockings. They would do fine." He had already stripped the guard of weapons and outer clothing. "And I'd like to wash up, too. In fact, I have to." It was pleasant to step through the detergent mist in Artemisia's bathroom. It left him perhaps a trifle over-scented, but the open air would take care of the fragrance, he hoped. At least he was clean, and it had required merely the momentary passage through the fine, suspended droplets that shot past him forcefully in a warm air stream. No special drying chamber was required since he stepped out dry as well as clean. They didn't have this on Nephelos or on Earth. The guard's uniform was a bit tight, and Byron did not like the way the somewhat ugly, conical military cap fit over his brachycephalic head. He stared at his reflection with some dissatisfaction.
"How do I look?"
"Quite like a soldier," she said. He said, "You'll have to carry one of these whips. I can't handle three." She took it between two fingers and dropped it into her bag, which was then suspended from her wide belt by another microforce so that her hands remained free.
"We had better go now. Don't say a word if we meet anyone, but let me do the talking. Your accent isn't right, and it would be impolite to talk in my presence unless you were directly addressed anyway. Remember, you're a common soldier."
The guard on the floor was beginning to wriggle a bit and roll his eyes. His wrists and ankles were securely tied in a clump at the small of his back with stockings that had the tensile strength of more than an equal amount of steel. His tongue worked futilely at his gag. He had been shoved out of the way so that it was not necessary to step over him to get to the door.
"This way," breathed Artemisia.
At the first turning, There was a footstep behind them, and a light hand came down on Byron's shoulder. Byron stepped to one side quickly and turned, one hand catching the other's arm, while his other snatched at his whip. But it was Gilbert who said, "Easy, man." Byron loosened his grip. Gilbert rubbed his arm. "I've been waiting for you, but that's no reason to break my bones. Let me stare admiringly at you, Farrell. Your clothes seem to have shrunk on you, but not bad, not bad at all. Nobody would look twice at you in that getup. It's the advantage of a uniform. It's taken for granted that a soldier's uniform holds a soldier and nothing else." "Uncle Gil," whispered Artemisia urgently, "don't talk so much. Where are the other guards?" "Everyone objects to a few words," he said pettishly. "The other guards are working their way up the tower. They've decided that our friend is on none of the lower levels, so they've just left some men at the main exits at the ramps, with the general alarm system in operation as well. We can get past it."
"Won't they miss you, sir?" asked Byron.
"Me?" "The captain was glad to see me go, for all his toe scraping. They won't look for me, I assure you."
They were speaking in whispers, but now even those died away. A guard stood at the bottom of the ramp, while two others flanked the large carved double door that led to the open air. Gilbert called out,
"Any word of the escaped prisoner, men?"
"No, my lord," said the nearest.
He clicked his heels together and saluted.
"Well, keep your eyes open."
And they walked past them and out. One of the guards at the door carefully neutralizing that section of the alarm as they left. It was nighttime outside. The sky was clear and starry, the ragged mass of the dark nebula blotting out the specks of light near the horizon. Palace Central was a dark mass behind them, and the palace field was less than half a mile away. But after 5 minutes of walking along the quiet path, Gilbert grew restless.
"There's something wrong," he said.
Artemisia said, "Uncle Gil, you haven't forgotten to arrange to have the ship ready."
"Of course not," he snapped at her, as nearly as one could snap in a whisper. "But why is the field tower lit up? It should be dark."
He pointed up through the trees to where the tower was a honeycomb of white light. Ordinarily, that would indicate business at the field, ships leaving for space or arriving from it. Gilbert muttered,
"Nothing was scheduled for tonight. That was definite."
They saw the answer at a distance, or Gilbert did. He stopped suddenly and spread his arms wide to hold back the others.
"That's all," he said, and giggled almost hysterically. "This time, Henrik has really messed things properly, the idiot. They're here, the Tirani. Don't you understand? That's Aratap's private armored cruiser."
Byron saw it, gleaming faintly under the lights, standing out among the other undistinguished ships. It was smoother, thinner, more feline than the Rhodian vessels. Gilbert said,
"The captain said a personage was being entertained today, and I paid no attention. There's nothing to do now. We can't fight Tirani."
Byron felt something suddenly snap.
"Why not?" he said savagely. "Why can't we fight them? They have no reason to suspect trouble, and we're armed. Let's take the commissioner's own ship. Let's leave him with his trousers down."
He stepped forward out of the relative obscurity of the trees and onto the bare field. The others followed. There was no reason to hide. They were two members of the royal family and an escorting soldier. But it was the Tirani they were fighting now. Symok Aratap of Tiran had been impressed the first time he had ever seen the palace grounds at Rhodia years earlier. But it had turned out to be only a shell that impressed him. The interior was nothing but a musty relic. 2 generations earlier, Rhodia's legislative chambers had met on these grounds, and most of the administrative offices had been quartered there. Palace Central had been the heartbeat of a dozen worlds. But now the legislative chambers, still existing, for the Khan never interfered with local legalisms, met once a year to ratify the executive orders of the past 12 months. It was quite a formality. The Executive Council was still, nominally, in continuous session,
but it consisted of a dozen men who remained on their estates 9 weeks in 10. The various executive bureaus were still active, since one could not govern without them, whether the director or the Khan ruled, but they were now scattered over the planet, made less dependent upon the director, more conscious of their new masters, the Tirani. Which left the palace as majestic as it had always been in stone and metal, and that only. It housed the directorial family, a scarcely adequate corps of servants, and an entirely inadequate corps of native guards. Aretab felt uncomfortable in the shell and was unhappy. It was late. He was tired. His eyes burned so that he longed to remove his contact lenses, and most of all, he was disappointed. There was no pattern. He glanced occasionally at his military aide, but the major was listening to the director with expressionless stolidity. As for Aretab himself, he paid little attention.
"Widimos' son, indeed," he would say in abstraction. Then later, "And so you arrested him. Quite right."
But it meant little to him, since events lacked a design. Aretab had a neat and tidy mind, which could not bear the thought of individual facts loosely clumped together with no decent arrangement. Widimos had been a traitor, and Widimos' son had attempted a meeting with the director of Rhodia. He had attempted it first in secret, and when that had failed, such was the urgency, he had attempted it openly with his ridiculous story of an assassination plot. Surely that must have been the beginning of a pattern. And now it fell apart. Henrik was giving up the boy with indecent haste. He would not even wait the night, it seemed. And that did not fit at all. Or else, Aretab had not yet learned all the facts. He focused his attention on the director again. Henrik was beginning to repeat himself. Aretab felt a twinge of compassion. The man had been made into such a coward that even the Tirani themselves grew impatient with him. And yet it was the only way. Only fear could ensure absolute loyalty. That and nothing else. Widimos had not been afraid. And despite the fact that his self-interest had been bound at every point with the maintenance of Tyranian rule, he had rebelled. Henrik was afraid, and that made the difference. And because Henrik was afraid, he sat there, lapsing into incoherence as he struggled to obtain some gesture of approval. The major would give none, of course, Aretab knew. The man had no imagination. He sighed and wished he had none either. Politics was a filthy business. So he said, with some air of animation,
"Quite so. I commend your quick decision and your zeal in the service of the Khan. You may be sure he will hear of it."
Henrik brightened visibly, his relief obvious. Aretab said,
"Have him brought in, then, and let us hear what our cockerel has to say."
He suppressed a desire to yawn. He had absolutely no interest in what the cockerel had to say. It was Henrik's intention at this point to signal for the captain of the guard, but there was no necessity for that, as the captain stood in the doorway, unannounced. "Excellency," he cried, and strode in without waiting for permission. Henrik stared hard at his hand, still inches from the signal, as though wondering whether his intention had somehow developed sufficient force to substitute for the act. He said uncertainly,
"What is it, Captain?"
The captain said, "Excellency, the prisoner has escaped." Aretab felt some of the weariness disappear. What was this?
"The details, Captain,"
he ordered, and straightened in his chair. The captain gave them with a blunt economy of words. He concluded, "I ask your permission, Excellency, to proclaim a general alarm. They are but yet minutes away."
"Yes, by all means," stuttered Henrik. "By all means. A general alarm, indeed. Just the thing. Quickly, quickly. Commissioner, I cannot understand how it could have happened. Captain, put every man to work. There will be an investigation, Commissioner. If necessary, every man on the guards will be broken. Broken! Broken!"
He repeated the word in near hysteria, but the captain remained standing. It was obvious that he had more to say. Aretab said,
Why do you wait?
May I speak to Your Excellency in private? Said the captain abruptly. Henrik cast a quick, frightened look at the bland, unperturbed commissioner. He mustered a feeble indignation.
There are no secrets from the soldiers of the Khan, our friends, our...
Say your say, Captain, interposed Aratap gently.
The captain brought his heels together sharply and said, Since I am ordered to speak, Your Excellency, I regret to inform you that my Lady Artemisia and my Lord Gilbert accompanied the prisoner in his escape.
He dared to kidnap them? Henrik was on his feet. And my guards allowed it?
They were not kidnapped, Excellency. They accompanied him voluntarily.
How do you know?
Aratap was delighted and thoroughly awake. It formed a pattern now, after all, a better pattern than he could have anticipated. The captain said, We have the testimony of the guard they overpowered, and the guards who, unwittingly, allowed them to leave the building. He hesitated, then added grimly, When I interviewed my Lady Artemisia at the door of her private chambers, she told me she had been on the point of sleep. It was only later that I realized that when she told me that, her face was elaborately made up. When I returned, it was too late. I accept the blame for the mismanagement of this affair. After tonight, I will request Your Excellency to accept my resignation, but first, have I still your permission to sound the general alarm? Without your authority, I could not interfere with members of the royal family. But Henrik was swaying on his feet and could only stare at him vacantly. Aratap said,
Captain, you would do better to look at the health of your director. I suggest you call his physician.
The general alarm, repeated the captain.
There will be no general alarm, said Aratap. Do you understand me? No general alarm. No recapture of the prisoner. The incident is closed. Return your men to their quarters and ordinary duties and look to your director. Come, Major.
The Turanian Major spoke tensely once they had left the mass of Palace Central behind them. Aratap, he said, I presume you know what you're doing. I kept my mouth shut in there on the basis of that presumption.
Thank you, Major.
Aratap liked the night air of a planet full of green and growing things. Turan was more beautiful in its way, but it was a terrible beauty of rocks and mountains. It was dry. Dry. He went on.
You cannot handle Henrik, Major Andros. In your hands, he would wilt and break. He is useful, but requires gentle treatment if he is to remain so.
The Major brushed that aside. I'm not referring to that. Why not the general alarm? Don't you want them?
Do you? Aratap stopped. Let us sit here for a moment, Andros. A bench on a pathway along a lawn. What more beautiful and what place is safer from spy beams? Why do you want the young man, Major?
Why do I want any traitor and conspirator?
Why do you, indeed, if you only catch a few tools while leaving the source of the poison untouched? Whom would you have? A cub? A silly girl? A senile idiot?
There was a faint splashing of an artificial waterfall nearby, a small one but decorative. Now that was a real wonder to Aratap. Imagine water spilling out, running to waste, pouring indefinitely down the rocks and along the ground. He had never educated himself out of a certain indignation over it. As it is, said the Major. We have nothing.
We have a pattern. When the young man first arrived, we connected him with Henrik, and that bothered us, because Henrik is what he is. But it was the best we could do. Now we see it was not Henrik at all, that Henrik was a misdirection. It was Henrik's daughter and cousin he was after, and that makes more sense.
Why didn't he call us sooner? He waited for the middle of the night.
Because he is the tool of whoever is the first to reach him, and Gilbert, I am sure, suggested this night meeting as a sign of great zeal on his part.
You mean we were called here on purpose, to witness their escape?
No, Not for that reason. Ask yourself, where do these people intend on going?
The major shrugged.
Rhodia is big.
Yes. If it were the young Farrell alone who was concerned. But where on Rhodia would two members of the royal family go unrecognized, particularly the girl?
They would have to leave the planet then. Yes, I agree.
And from where? They can reach the palace field in a 15-minute walk. Now, do you see the purpose of our being here?
The major said.
Our ship?
Of course. A Turanian ship would seem ideal to them. Otherwise, they would have to choose among freighters. Farrell has been educated on Earth and, I'm sure, can fly a cruiser.
Now there's a point. Why do we allow the nobility to send out their sons in all directions? What business has a subject to know more about travel than will suffice him for local trade? We bring up soldiers against us.
Nevertheless, said Aretab with polite indifference, at the moment Farrell has a foreign education, and let us take that into account objectively, without growing angry about it. The fact remains that I am certain they have taken our cruiser.
I can't believe it.
You have your wrist collar. Make contact with the ship if you can.
The major tried, futilely. Aretab said,
try the field tower.
The major did so, and the small voice came out of the tiny receiver in minute agitation. But, Excellency, I don't understand. There is some mistake. Your pilot took off 10 minutes ago. Aretab was smiling.
You see, work out the pattern, and each little event becomes inevitable. And now do you see the consequences?
The major did. He slapped his thigh and laughed briefly.
Of course, he said.
Well, said Aretab. They couldn't know, of course, but they have ruined themselves. Had they been satisfied with the clumsiest Rhodian freighter on the field, they would surely have escaped, and, what's the expression? I would have been caught with my trousers down this night. As it is, my trousers are firmly belted, and nothing can save them. And when I pluck them back, in my own good time,
he emphasized the words with satisfaction,
I will have the rest of the conspiracy in my hands as well.
He sighed and found himself beginning to feel sleepy once more.
Well, we have been lucky, and now there is no hurry. Call Central Base and have them send another ship after us.